the complex terminology of the white man's law. But when they spoke of how they used their land, of how they subsisted on its bounty, and of how they had fought others to protect it, they were actually describing in layman's terms the basis of Aboriginal or Indian title. This was what gave dignity and translated land claims into land rights. Much of the native testimony addressed the issue of how the lands had been used since time immemorial to demonstrate that these lands had always been theirs and were still theirs at the time of the testimony. Congressmen were concerned as to how assets received from settlement legislation would be used. Some of them confided they had heard horror stories about Indian spending sprees following per capita distributions. Testimony about constructive plans for the use of Settlement Act monies reassured them, and they needed reassuring. They understood, the congressman did, economic development, and they approved of it as an objective. This, after all, was a concept very common in their world. So we spoke about plans for economic development because it made sense and because it was reassuring to the members of the congressional committees. The Tlingitahaitis had had considerable experience in planning for the use of their judgment fund. They were cognizant of the approval gained from congressmen who were made privy to plans that were intended to benefit as large a number of the tribe as possible in anticipation of a settlement fund, or in this case, an ANCSA settlement fund. Native subsistence hunting and fishing on state lands still faces political opposition by people who do not or refuse to understand its place in the native culture or lifestyle. It's interesting to note that the federal government has been more forthright in acting in the best interest of the natives in subsistence hunting and fishing than has the state of Alaska. While the loss of native lands did not cease with the passage of ANCSA, because ANCSA, curiously, was actually a two-edged sword. The one edge of the sword accomplished what we sought. It confirmed in title in excess of 40 million acres to the Alaska Natives. We always object to the any terminology suggesting that ANCSA gave 40 million acres. We claimed virtually all of the land. We agreed in the face of a recognition of what could be accomplished politically to settle for the 40 plus million acres. Thus, the legislation did confirm that title. To that extent, it was a clear victory. The economic power of the native corporations and the re-energized tribal governing bodies that are asking questions about what their powers and rights may be have helped the natives achieve a greater measure of self-determination. But it is difficult to measure a process in which realized goals are quickly replaced by unrealized ones. But perhaps our expanding expectations is another indication that we continue to grow as a people. And very accurately, as it was described earlier, self-determination, as we discussed it in those early days, was also measured not only in a positive sense by opposing what we as a people hope to accomplish, but it was also presented as freedom from interference by the Department of Interior and the BIA, who much of the native leadership felt had not been too successful in addressing over many, many years the concerns that had been repeatedly expressed by the native people. Cultural integrity seems almost impossible to maintain in the midst of change. But if we translate it not as an effort to prevent change, but as one to control it and to influence it, then it's clear that the increased economic muscle afforded the Alaska Natives through their corporations and through their ownership of their lands, does place in their hands a tool that will give them a greater opportunity to shape the extent and nature of the change that will take place with respect to their culture. To ANCSA to be made maximally effective requires, I think, a visionary, courageous leadership, unafraid of looking to the past, unafraid of admitting that the spirit which moved the people to unite and to lobby ANCSA through the Congress is as important in its successful administration today as it was then. I'm firmly of the opinion that our success in shepherding ANCSA through the Congress and against a much better financed, better organized, more experienced opposition is much more than the totality of the individual efforts or experiences that accompanied it. I think there was a spiritual undergirding that firmly united the people in those challenging and trying days. ANCSA is not so much a final answer as it is an opportunity. It will not reach fruition, full fruition, if its leadership becomes too engrossed with the necessity of annual re-election efforts. Corporate leadership is simply not up to the task by itself and should not be expected to reach those answers by itself. This explains the one dismal failure of the ANCSA corporations. It is not, in my opinion, a failure of ANCSA itself, and that is the education of its shareholders. It is not enough that the shareholders be told of corporate activities, which is required as a matter of law anyway. Their basic understanding of the functions of boards of directors and management and corporations need energetic, objective assistance from a well-developed program approved by but independent of the corporations, whose approach to dispensing information tends to be self-serving. Maybe corporations are not the final answer. As one of the prime movers of corporations as a vehicle for the administration of ANCSA assets, I admit I've certainly reached the point of questioning whether corporations are up to the job. Somehow they seem to lack the closeness to the people of tribal governing bodies, and somehow, even though they are perpetual in their existence, they do not seem to possess the personal, timeless quality that, in my opinion, tribal governing bodies have. But ANCSA achieved its main objective, the title to 40 plus million acres, and the transmittal of that title to the original owners, the Alaska Natives. On that basis alone, I consider it an unparalleled success. But I think we need to maintain a perspective about what ANCSA is. It is a tool. It is a launching pad. It is, above all else, an opportunity. It is also a landmark that we can use and that we can watch as we steer our course into the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Borbridge, for that most complete and eloquent statement. I think we might as well stay with our plan and ask Don Wright to speak now, and then we'll carry on from there. Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's important to emphasize the fact that the paper drawn is excellent in retrospect, in showing what happened. based on the written information that was contained in those particular documents that were prepared by the Congress of the United States. I think that it's not reflective of the feeling of the people. It's not reflective of the feeling of the Congress. It's not reflective of the feeling of the administrators or political leaders of the state of Alaska. I think it's important to note that we were under tremendous threat and stress during the time of these hearings. There was no money to go into the villages and get the real testimony from the real people, the grassroots people. The only opportunity we had was to attempt to reflect the feelings of the real people as leaders under the threat of possibly going to jail, of possibly being punished economically, socially. And we testified in many instances under instructions from attorneys, under instructions from church leaders, under instructions from the Bureau of Indian Affairs personnel, of the state personnel, the Attorney General's Office of the state, the Governor's Office, and we were instructed that to really say what we thought would probably stop everything. And that if you're going to deal with intelligent people such as those that represent the Congress and those that represent the state and the major industrial economic factions, that you had to do it sort of through an interpreter and sort of through a lobbyist and so on and so forth. So I feel as we moved forward with the Native Land Claims Settlement Act, we knew of sovereignty. We knew of integrity and of tradition and of native religion, not Christianity. We knew of all these things. We worked with people from all realms involving these things, but we were motivated mostly by attempting to defend ourselves to the best of our ability and not lose everything. So as a result of that, we attempted to satisfy the tribal organizations, the sovereign individual organizations, which at the time of the blanket claims amounted to something near 39 or 40 individual organizations that felt the real sovereign meaning of land and the control and the ownership. And some of those claims were overlapping one another. So we had to attempt to resolve those disputes without focusing attention on that attempt. And the evolution of the village corporation and the regional corporation and at one point a statewide corporation was a unified attempt to defend against the intruder, the trespasser. We asked on many occasions the leaders in Congress, men like Senator Jackson and Congressman Aspinall, members of the White House, staff like Brad Patterson and some of those guys, what are our chances? Our chances were reflected in the first bills that were introduced by Roger C.B. Morton, for an example, representing the administration. After all of these hearings, they introduced a bill for 1 million acres of land and $100 million settlement. We were put in a position where we had to do something drastic to change that, and we even, in some instances, threatened war, bloodshed, feeling that it would be the only way we could get them to focus on the real issue of sovereignty, the real issue of the fact that the native people had their own law and they owned the land. And we were advised by Indian tribes from the lower 48 on many occasions, to reject totally the corporate concept and maintain strictly a tribal concept. But from the other side of the aisle, Mr. Jackson and Mr. Aspinall and the likes said that they would do nothing and that we could die with nothing if we didn't straighten up. We're told that by major oil company representatives, by major timber representatives, major mining companies, even people from the chambers of commerce on tourism and things like that. They said, you will take what you get and be thankful for it. So we would withdraw from time to time and try to reevaluate and decide what really should we do. I can recall in one instance when Emil Nadi was the president of the Federation, we suggested that they divide the state, perhaps divide it on the basis of the PYK line. We all know that when Congress authorized statehood, they put the disclaimer clause protecting native rights in that act, as they put in the Constitution of the State of Alaska. And as a matter of fact, the Congress in its wisdom did divide the state on the PYK line, the Porcupine, Yukon, Kuskokwim, and would only allow the state to make selections south of the PYK line unless they could get permission from the President of the United States to select north, which would have been and was Prudhoe Bay, as a matter of fact. I remember when I was working with the state legislators, I personally, along with Francis Degnan and Brenda Itta from Point Barrow, personally hand-carried a petition to every senator and every House of Representative member in the state legislature, to the governor and all of his cabinet, asking them to sign the petition in support of the then AFN position, which clearly stated our intent to go for $1 billion, 60 million acres of land, and a 2% overriding royalty in perpetuity. The 2% overriding royalty in perpetuity would have been the true evidence of native sovereignty, because it would have allowed us to share in 2% of the wealth of this state, our land, forever. It may sound strange, but I managed, with the assistance of Francis Degnan and Brenda Itta, to obtain the signatures of a majority of the Alaska State Senate and the signatures of a majority of the Alaska State House of Representatives. And when I took it to Governor Egan, he called in his Attorney General and others and asked them to lobby and ask for senators and representatives to retract their signature of that petition. It got pretty tough. One man was, in my opinion, gutsy enough to withdraw his signature. He was a banker in town here, a state senator. And the headlines in the Anchorage Daily Times was that Wright hoodwinks the legislature. Well, needless to say, there was no hoodwinking. They all knew what they signed. They were all men and women, honorable. I found that very distasteful. But in the spirit of the fight, we made 1,000 copies, and we made 2,000 copies of that petition, along with the pictures and the biography of each of these representatives and senators. And we sent copies of that to every United States senator and every United States House member and all the King's men, the cabinet, to the President of the United States, and so on and so forth, asking them to support us. Well, after all of that effort, they came down with this bill, million acres and $100 million. And we had to do something else. So I personally went to the Russian embassy and asked them to give me an interpretation of the Treaty of Session, wherein it says that the United States Congress shall have the authority to deal with the uncivilized natives in a similar manner to which it has dealt with the Indians in America in the past. My question to the Russian embassy was this: did the Russians, at the time of the Treaty of Session, consider the natives of Alaska civilized or uncivilized? They said that was a very delicate question, that they didn't know how to respond to that, and it would have tremendous implications internationally, so they chose not to answer that question. I submit to you and to this oversight, this overview group, that we should get an answer from the Soviet Union. Are we civilized or are we not? Now, if we were civilized, we're certainly entitled to equal rights, the defense of our property, the right to hold it forever, unless public necessity clearly requires that it be taken from us for a reasonable public purpose, and then only on the basis of compensation. So I feel that the true meaning of ANCSA was just exactly what's happened. It was a smokescreen designed by big corporate influence over the Congress of the United States to expropriate merely private property from Alaska Native people. I represent at this time a small tribe of Indians north of the Yukon, the Venati. They, in my view, are a sovereign nation. And we've been under fire from the state government and the federal government ever since they chose, under the terms of ANCSA, to retain the land and take no money. But it's interesting to note that there are only 303 people there. And the United States government saw fit to confirm title in fee simple to 1.8 million acres of land. If you extended that 1.8 million acres of land on a per capita basis, it would have nearly given every native in Alaska the same amount of land that the natives in Venati hold title to per capita, and it would have encompassed the entire state. Now, it's inconceivable to me that the Congress of the United States and the President and all of his men and all the powerful lawyers and corporations in the country, it's inconceivable to me that they could have permitted this disparagance, this difference between peoples, and knowingly, in violation of the Constitution, enacted ANCSA on the basis of race alone. It was a racial act. It is a racial act. I don't know where we would go from here, or what recourse might be taken as the next step in proving Indian title, in proving just benefits. In retrospect, you look at the wanton waste of our state, the wanton waste of our mineral resource and the revenues from it, and still the state fights us over simple things like culture, like native identity, like subsistence. In the case of Venati, there's a case pending before the state court that's been appealed twice, wherein the tribal hunting party killed several caribou, subsistence, and distributed the caribou meat to the villagers in May, out of season. the Fish and Game came in there like Nazis with an aircraft and confiscated the meat and charged an old man with possession, and he didn't even kill the animal. It was merely hanging in a tribal cache on tribal property, and it's a private closed airport, and the state had no authority to come in there to do anything. The judge in the magistrate in Fort Yukon was afraid to handle the case because of the pressures, so they moved it to Fairbanks, and Judge Klein ruled, ordered it dismissed on the basis that the Fish and Game had no regulations promulgated on subsistence use of meats. And the state had dismissed several other cases previous to this. The state, I don't know how much money it's spent so far, but for example, I think it's probably spent $500,000 on this little case. They appealed Judge Klein's ruling. And the next judge ruled him, remanded it back to trial. Well, it's been going on for pretty near 2 years, and I suspect intellectually it'll probably go on for 20 or 30 years and cost the people and the government several millions of dollars. We will not give up. We will not give up. And the state will not give up. And who pays for it? The Indian, Eskimo, and Aleut people pay for it. Every citizen in America pays for it. So I think that there's a time, and I think the time is now, to take a fresh look and identify and clarify sovereignty. That's what it's all about. The right to govern yourself. The smallest increment of government we have under our system is a city, first or second class city. You don't see the borough moving into a city and trying to change their law. You don't see the state moving into a borough and trying to change their law. You don't see the federal government moving into a state and trying to change their law. Why does everyone pick on the Indian, Eskimo, and Aleut people? Why can't we have our law? And why can't they, when they come to visit us, abide by our law? We have to abide by theirs when we're here. So I think this commission, and particularly in view of the light that we know it's international, and that we, at this time, have an opportunity to take it before the United Nations, that we should do that. And we should encourage the state to get involved in this discussion.